I would like to thank Alex and Malavika for the invitation. Is this on? Okay. This is also a report on some joint work that Malavika and I have been doing over the past number of years. Let me begin with a little bit of notation. The first one, of course, isn't serious. Can you see this? So I want to use notation for the first quadrant. I guess we're really interested in maximal functions over certain sets in Rn, but it's a little bit more convenient to work in the first quadrant where everything is positive, because I'm interested in monomials. Usually you think of a monomial as simply the coordinates to various integer powers, but if I keep everything positive, then I can take this to any real powers. And so I will mean by a monomial simply a product, as I've written there, of x1 to the p1 and so on, where p, boldface p, is supposed to be simply a vector in Rn. And then a monomial, polyhedron, is a set where some finite collection of these monomials are bounded by certain constants. So my picture is that I have various monomial surfaces, and it's the set where all of these things are less than constants. Of course, the fact that it's less doesn't make any difference, because I can look at 1 over something to make it bigger. This doesn't make a difference. In particular, I want to introduce this kind of a ball. So I'm going to fix this collection. I think it's a German P, at least that's what it says in the tech manual, of points in Rn. So that means I'm going to fix a certain number of monomials, and I'm going to, for each point in the first quadrant, I'm going to look at the set of points where this finite collection of monomials differs by some amount delta j. So this is some kind of a ball centered at the point x, and it's a d parameter family of balls, and I'm interested, of course, in the case where d presumably is much larger than the dimension n. So it's given by lots of these surfaces. And what we're interested in are certain maximal averages over these sets. So let's take a spanning set. Clearly, I need to have some condition in order that these sets have finite measure, finite volume. So let's take a spanning set, and now, for each x, let's look at the maximal average of a locally integrable function over all these sets. This gives me a certain kind of maximal function. If, for example, I were to take for my monomials simply the coordinate functions, this is giving me back the strong maximal function. I'm looking at averages over rectangles parallel to the axes, but presumably this is more general. This dominates the strong maximal function. In work with Malavika, we proved that in this case, this maximal operator is bounded on all LP, P bigger than 1, less than or equal to infinity. So I don't want to talk about that result, but I want to talk about one extra thing that we managed to prove, which is that if you look at the vector 1, this is the one with 1, 1, 1, 1 all the way down, and you ask that this vector not lie on any of the hyperplanes generated by n minus 1 of the elements in this collection P. In other words, it's sort of a generic thing. If it stays away from this finite collection of hyperplanes, then in fact this maximal function at near L1 basically has the same behavior as a strong maximal function. I should quickly say what the strong maximal function is. This is where I'm taking the supremum, the maximal function at a point x is the supremum of averages over all rectangles, where the rectangles are or any rectangle containing x with sides parallel to the axis. And by the behavior near L1, I mean going back to the early result of Yes and Marcinkiewicz and Zygmund, which give us estimates for sort of weak type, what kind, where, with the measure of the set where this is bigger than alpha and involves sort of L log L classes. So how does one prove this good behavior of the maximal function? The idea is that if you look at these balls that I'm interested in here, as I said, they're cut out by D, or say 2D monomial inequalities. So this is one, then there's a second one, and a third one, and so on. The idea is that under this assumption on the vector 1, that one can find a larger set where I throw away all except n of the inequalities, and the larger set that I get has comparable measure, comparable volume, which means that when I'm looking at averages over this very complicated set, it's basically comparable to the average over something involving exactly n, and then it's not very hard to see that that's up to some change of coordinates, nothing but a maximal function again, a strong maximal function. So the idea is that when one satisfies this vector 1, 1, 1 satisfies this generic condition, the maximal function is really dominated by a sum of a finite number of maximal functions, and so has the same behavior near L1. Unfortunately, this condition on the vector 1 can't be removed. So here's an example. Let's work in two dimensions. So we're looking in the first quadrant in the plane, and I'm going to take from my set of points 1, 0, 0, 1, and 1, 1. If you think about what that means, now this is a legitimate picture. The vector 1, 1 corresponds simply to the monomial x1, 0, 1 corresponds to x2, and 1, 1 corresponds to x1, x2. Of course, the vector 1, 1 is in a subspace spanned by some collection of these. It's one of the vectors itself. What do these monomial polyhedra look like? Monomial polyhedra. So I have some band running this way given by the function x2, some band running this way given by the function x1, and some band running this way perhaps given by the function x1, x2. So I want to look at such a set where I've chosen some small number c and some large number n. So x is between c and n, y is between c and n, and xy is between c squared and 2. So you should think of this as being very large in the x1 and x2 directions, but not too big in the xy direction. And now you ask, can we replace this sixfold intersection, or if you like, the intersection given by these three monomials, by a collection involving only two monomials? And there are only three possibilities. We can eliminate the x1, x2, we can eliminate the x2, or we can eliminate the x1, and we get these three possible larger sets. But then it's rather easy to make computations as to the volumes of these sets. One can compute explicitly. These three sets are just rectangles and some new coordinates, so that's easy to compute. And B is contained in a larger set that's very easy to compute. And if you look at the ratio, you get these possibilities. And now if I choose C to be n e to the minus n, it's easy to check the limit as n goes to infinity, goes to infinity. So there's no possible uniform bound that one can have. Yeah. No, no, that's the point of the talk. We had proved previously that this maximal function is still bounded on LP for p bigger than 1, but what's not clear is what the behavior near L1 is. That's the focus, all right? So I've sort of indicated how one might go about proving the maximal function if you can replace these arbitrary sets by a collection of n sets, I have not indicated how to prove it if you can't, and that's involved some work. But the question is now, what can one say about the behavior near L1 of these non-generic sets of this type? All right? And so what I want to try to show you today is that one can, in this case, actually have a different method of proof that goes by a covering lemma argument, which does show that this maximal function does have the right behavior near L1, the expected behavior. All right? So what I want to do is I want to restrict my attention to a special class of sets. I should really have a covering lemma for all possible triple intersections, right, if I want to analyze the maximal function by some kind of a covering argument. But if you think about it, if you look back at the counterexample, or the example I gave, the really difficult situation is one in which I have rather long arms this way and rather small width this way. And one can show, I'm not going to do it, that really the heart of the matter is to look at the sets that I've written here. So I allow my x to go all the way down to 0, my y all the way down to 0, and xy between 0 and gamma. So I think I have a picture of such a set. That's what it's supposed to look like, right? It's the thing underneath a hyperbola, but very long arms, presumably. And what I want to do is to have some kind of covering lemma for sets of this type. Of course, if I want to really prove a maximal function, I have to worry about all the other sets that are involved, but one has to then divide the sets into various classes. Some can be handled by this maximal function, and the others can be handled by the more standard maximal functions. So what do I mean by the standard maximal functions? There are three variants that I'm interested in. There is this classical strong maximal function that I mentioned already. Here I'm working only in R2. I can look at averages over rectangles with sides parallel to the axes. Or I can use the two functions x and xy, or the functions y and xy. In either case, I get two parameter families of sets, and I can define three maximal functions. M0 corresponds to the classical strong one. Then I have M1 and M2, depending on whether I'm looking at sets . So for example, an element in this class F1 looks like this. I'm using two bounds on x and two bounds on xy, so they will be sets that look like that one, right? And I'm looking at maximal averages over such sets, and the claim is that all three of these maximal functions are have the right behavior at L1. That the measure of the set where they're bigger than alpha is dominated by something involving the L log L class. For J equals 0, this is the classical Jensen, Marcinkiewicz-Zygmund theorem. And the other things, you just make a change of variables and you're dealing with strong maximal functions on rectangles, but with respect to slightly different measures, but these measures decompose into products and it's not very hard to push through the same theory. And what I'm going to be interested in, what I then know something about, are anything that can be dominated by either one of these three maximal functions. So I'm going to introduce M hat to be the sum of these three known maximal functions. Okay? So now let me tell you what the covering lemma is. I should say that our work on this covering lama is very much inspired by the work and paper of Cordoba and Pfefferman on a geometric proof of the strong maximal function. And I'm not sure it's word for word the same proof, but it's pretty close. Somehow some of the ideas, I think, you can trace back to that. So here is the theorem. It says, suppose we have, I forgot to say. I'm going to look now at this particular class of sets. So this is alpha, this is beta, and this is xy equals gamma. And notice that, well, what I want to require is that gamma should be less than or equal to, n times gamma should be less than or equal to alpha times beta. And I'm going to choose some large number n later, after we see what we need. What is the point here? So this is the class of sets that we're going to be dealing with. That's what I mean by script H sub n. It's a set of this type. Suppose I have a collection of sets of this type. Then I claim I can find a subsequence which satisfies the usual thing that one wants in a covering lemma. First of all, I've captured enough of the measure, that is, the measure of the union of the original things is bounded by the measure of this smaller collection, right? So I still have somehow some control. On the other hand, I want to claim that the sets that I've chosen are more, sort of morally, they're disjoint. You can't expect that. But what I want to know is something about the sum of its characteristic functions. And so what we're going to prove is that if I take any non-negative function f and integrate against the sum of the characteristic functions, that's dominated by this good maximal function that I had before, which I had control over, integrated over the union of the original sets. This, for example, if I now use the fact that this m hat, for example, is bounded in LP, I can get an estimate on the LQ norm of this sum in terms of the measures of the union, and this is the kind of estimate that one needs in using a maximal function, right? So these are somehow the critical conditions that one wants. Okay. The next slide is terrible. More notation. I wrote this all down. What does this mean? So given one of these sets, I want to look at certain subsets of it. Basically, you can forget about the ry and the sy. What I want to focus on is the rx, sx, and q. And instead of staring at that, maybe the following picture helps. The thing outlined in red is my original set P. And now what I'm doing is I'm going to chop off this rectangular part. That's called the R part of the RX part of this. And this part over here is called the SX part of the set. There are, of course, also an RY and an SY when I'm looking at it from the other direction. And finally, there is this rectangle down at the bottom, which I'm going to call Q. All right? So I'm sorry about it, but that seems to be what one needs here.
With the capital N coming into this?
Pardon?
With capital N coming into this?
Yes. What we're going, well, can almost tell you, there are certain geometric facts about these sets that I will know if I take n large enough, and I only have to do this two or three times. Right. Right. Look, I must have already talked about this, but what is the idea? the larger N is means that, I mean, after all, this point up here is the point alpha beta, and if gamma were bigger than alpha beta, then this hyperbola would be out here somewhere, and the set that I would be interested in is just a rectangle, in which case I don't have to worry about it. It's controlled by the ordinary maximal function. I have to worry about cases where this set is not comparable to this rectangle, which means I can take n large. And those are really the difficult sets. I don't know if this makes any sense. Yeah? And we'll see in a minute where it comes from. So, let's try to prove the covering lemma. How does one select the subsequence? So, I start with an arbitrary countable collection of sets in this class, and let me order them. There's no loss in generality in assuming that I'm ordering them so that this dimension, the gamma dimension, is decreasing. All right? There's a certain symmetry here. One could have done it any other way as well, but this is one way to start. And now, how do we go about choosing the subsequence? Well, I choose P1, P sub N1 to be the first one, the one with the largest gamma. Right? And then, once I've done that, how do I choose the next one? Well, I go on until I reach a point where the intersection of this one with the one I've already chosen is only a small portion of the one that I've got. All right? This is basically the Cordova-Pfefferman scheme of picking these. There will be a first J such that this is true. That gives me an N2. Then N3 will be the first J after that, and so on. If I assume that I've picked K of them, then I choose NK plus 1. Well, I suppose I assume that I've picked K of them so that I have this condition for each K, for each J less than or equal to K, and then I choose the next one to be the smallest integer J such that I again have this small intersection property with the ones that have already been chosen. Okay, here's where we begin to see something about, oh, I should have said that this epsilon naught, actually, I don't quite know why it's epsilon naught. It could have been a half. I must have been trying to do something else at some point when I wrote the notes down. But, okay, so next I want to state there are sort of two geometric propositions, and this is the first one. Suppose I have any sequence, Pj, from this collection. Now remember that the Rj's are the rectangles over on the left, and the Sj's are the stuff under the hyperbola. And I claim that there's an absolute constant such that the measure of the union of the rectangles is dominated by the measure of the union of the hyperbolic parts, There's a similar statement in the y direction, which I don't care about. Or I do care about, but it's done exactly the same way. And then as a consequence, once one has this estimate, then the union of the stuff under the hyperbolas is certainly dominated by the union of everything, but each of these is simply this thing plus the part that I have control over. So basically the union of everything is comparable to the union of just the stuff under the hyperbolas. I can throw away the rectangular stuff, right? Let's prove this. So this is what I want to show. So let's let E be the union of the stuff under the hyperbolas. And now let's let R upper X tilde, what is R upper X? R upper X is this rectangle, right? R upper X tilde, I'm simply going to make it twice as wide. All right? And now I observe that if I look at the integral, I let E, as I said, is this union. If I look at the average of the characteristic function of that union, because of the assumption that N was less than or equal to 2, this is the first assumption that I need on N. So this is rather large. So the claim is that, of course, what might happen is that my set stops somehow before I've doubled this. But the fact that N is at least 2 means that this set actually continues out beyond where this enlarged rectangle goes. And so the measure of this is bigger than or equal to 1. Because of this, one gets this estimate. The point is that this average is bigger than a constant, independent of the rectangle. The point is that I'm looking at this measure divided by that measure, and it's bounded by something, independent of the choice. Well, what does that say? The union of the rectangles that I want are certainly contained in the union of the larger and large rectangles. But now, what this statement says, this is an average that I'm taking with respect to rectangles parallel to the axis. And it says that the strong maximal function must be bigger than or equal to 1/2 log 2 at all points in that set of rectangles. So the set that I'm interested in is contained in the set where the maximal function is large. And so, for example, I know that the strong maximal function is bounded on any LP, p bigger than 1, and I have the usual kind of estimate. So what I get is that the measure of this is bounded by this constant times the measure of E, which is what I wanted. Okay? Okay. There's a second geometric proposition, which I think I will save for a moment. Now, in order to prove the covering lemma, I have to prove two things. I have to prove that I've got enough sets that it's ample, and also that they're somehow that they're more or less disjoint. So let's worry about showing that it's ample. Okay? So I want to prove this. I want to prove that the union of the original ones is the measure of that is bounded by a constant times the measure of the ones I've selected. Well, let's take some thing in the original sequence, some p sub j, which was not selected. Then this j appears between two integers that are selected, and what that tells me is that since j is not selected, the intersection of pj with the earlier ones must be bigger than this value of pj. And now, of course, I can replace this finite union by the union of all of them, so I have this statement, right? Okay, but PJ is the part under the hyperbola plus the rectangle, so the intersection is bigger, the intersection of the SJs is bigger than the intersection of the PJs where I've subtracted off the rectangular part. But basically the idea here is that I know what the size of the rectangular part is, and if I choose N large enough, this is, again, where I need some condition on N, I can give up some of this, say half of this, and absorb this into this term, and so what I get is simply that the measure of this intersect everything is bigger than a certain constant times the measure of the one that I'm interested in. But now I observe that the region under the hyperbola is one of the sets that belongs to the class F1, and I have a good maximal function for that class of sets. So what this says, again, is that the M1 maximal function of this characteristic function is positive at all points, and of course that gives the estimate that we want. So the measure, the union over all of the SJs, where J is not in the section, in the sequence that I've selected, is bounded by the measure of everything. This tells me that the union of the stuff under the hyperbolas is controlled in the right way, but now I have to throw in the stuff that's in the rectangles, but by the earlier proposition, the stuff in the earlier rectangles is dominated by the stuff under the hyperbolas, so it's okay. And this gives the proof of A. I think it gives the proof of the situation where I'm running vertically. If I want to prove the one running horizontally, I have to use the maximal function F2. Okay. Now there's a second geometric proposition. So now instead of referring to an arbitrary sequence of these sets, let's look at the sequence that we've actually picked out. And I claim that there's an absolute constant so that, for example, the first statement is that the area under the hyperbola is bounded by the area under the hyperbola minus any stuff that I had before. All right? Similarly in the y direction. And now remember what the q's were. The q's were the little rectangles in the corner. And here I have a similar statement that the measure of the thing in the corner is bounded by the stuff in the corner minus, but instead of minus the stuff that comes before, this is minus the stuff that comes after. There's this little twist here. So here it's the stuff before, here it's the stuff after. Okay, let me defer the proof of proposition 2 for a minute and go on to the proof of part B of the covering lemma. Let me remind you, what we wanted to prove was this inequality that I've rewritten here, that the integral of f against the sum of the characteristic functions is dominated by the integral of this sum of three maximal functions. So how do we do it? We write down this integral, and we write it as a sum of integrals over these sets P and K of F. But now, since F is bigger than or equal to 0, I want to write the integral over the set P and K. That's less than or equal to the integral over the stuff underneath the hyperbola, plus the stuff that's to the left of the hyperbola, plus the stuff that's in the rectangle. Right? So I'm going to get three different terms here. Of course, I've repeated some stuff more than once. There's some area that's being counted twice, namely this stuff in between. But I don't care about that. So what I want to do is to estimate each one of these three terms separately. So let's look at the integral over the region underneath the hyperbola. I write it as its area times the average. But this average, this area, is bounded by the proposition whose proof I haven't given you, of this minus the stuff that comes before. And what I have here is the M1 maximal function. I can dominate it by the M1 maximal function. So, because of this, what I have is this area times the M1 maximal function, and that's less than or equal to the integral of the M1 maximal function over this set. And now if I sum, I get that the sum of all of these terms is bounded by the integral of the M1 maximal function. In a similar way, if I look at the y parts, that'll be dominated by the M2 parts. And the trick here is the same. Finally, I have to look at the integral over these little rectangles in the corner. It's the same idea, but this time I throw in everything that goes beyond. And the same thing, but here I'm dominating by the zero maximal function. All right? So these three terms give rise to the three maximal functions that I allow myself. All right, I have a few minutes, so let me say something about the proof of this other proposition that I owe you. The first two, one and two, are not very hard. Let's look at one, for example. I know this inequality is the way in which I chose the polynomials, so that it says that the part of the polynomial in what I chose before is very small. That says the part what I chose minus the stuff before is bigger than some constant times what I have. So I can estimate SNX minus the stuff that comes before. I'm going to make it smaller by taking away more. I'm going to throw in the P's. But since SN is P minus RN, I can replace this SNX here by PN and subtract off the RNX. And so I get this estimate on the volume, but from the earlier proposition, I know that this part is very small compared to this part, so I can absorb it into one half of it. And everything works provided that I can do the absorption, which is, again, another condition on N. So this is how one does the first two parts. The Y part is exactly the same. The last one, give me a bit of a heart attack when I first realized that we had to do it in the opposite direction rather than one before. But this is simply the observation. Remember, we're choosing this sequence of monomials in such a way that the constant that describes the hyperbola is decreasing. So suppose I have P naught, which I've chosen, and P1, which gets chosen later, so that mu is less than or equal to lambda. And I have this selection criteria, which is how things are chosen. Then I claim it's just a matter of geometry to sort of stare at what these pictures look like, that one of these three conditions must hold. This says either that, to draw the picture. I'm not sure that this is particularly clear as to the meaning, but suppose I have, here is P naught that I've chosen, right? And now the claim is that once I've chosen this, there is some absolute constant, so that if I, whoops, this is the wrong way. Let me draw this rectangle. And now the one that I've chosen is something inside here. But the claim is that there is a certain set up here so that if I take any later monomial, it will contain the cube corresponding to a later polynomial will not have any points inside here. So they get smaller and smaller and smaller, and that allows me to say that I can add up all of the terms that come later. It's late, and I think technicalities like this are hard to understand in the talk anyhow, so maybe I'll quit at this point. Thank you. It doesn't come, as far as we know, from a particular singular integral. We were led to this kind of question by considering certain domains in several complex variables, domains of the form where you look at the imaginary part of, say, the n plus variable, bigger than or equal to a sum, say, of monomials. And if you slice this domain and look at sort of a slice at height delta, one is led to complex sets that look very much like these monomial polyhedral sets. So what we really needed was some kind of geometric analysis of these polyhedral sets. In particular, we want estimates on their volume, and so on.
But so generally, your proof not much use this monomial structure, some geometrical.
The proof that I gave here, yes, it uses crucially the explicit forms of these three, you know, x, y, and x times y. An obvious question is, I'm not making any claim about more generally that the maximal function for any collection of monomial polyhedra has the right behavior or has the classical behavior near L1. That's, we don't know. All we were able to do was sort of do this particular example. I think there are some things here that are a little bit suggestive. There's some kind of an induction and so on. But it gets quite complicated. You have these things and you cut something out. You need to be able to compute volumes and so on. To get explicit forms for this abstract, in general, I think seems to be rather complicated. Yeah?